It does. Yeah, okay. Let me see if I can help you with that. Okay, but let me know if there's any problems. Anyway, I haven't given you in the last couple of classes much chance for questions, and I thought maybe we could start off with just a couple of open forum type questions. I know that Ken, you had given me one. Maybe I've answered it already. Do you remember what it was? Okay, maybe it'll come back to you about maybe 2 a.m. Oh, that's what it was. Okay. Okay, was there automatic excommunication for those that were communists? I believe so, yes. It's one of the things we'll talk about tonight. There was very strong condemnations of communism, and almost nothing was said about communism at Vatican Council II. So, you know what had happened, and this is part of our agenda tonight. In 1962, there had been an agreement made between Rome and Moscow, and John the 23rd had promised, "We will not condemn communism," at Vatican Council II. Okay, any other quick open forum questions anybody's has been having on their mind? Yes. Okay. I'll just rephrase it for the recording here. The question was there little said about Our Lady at Vatican Council II? You know, I'm not 100% sure, but I think little was said. More should have been said. But when you have all kinds of non-Catholic observers there and you don't want to convert them, or there's no real efforts to convert them, then there can be a real hesitancy to talk about the things that offend Protestants. And we're going to talk about that today also, the non-Catholics that were invited. Okay, any other quick questions? All right, it seems like that takes care of that. Just wanted to also mention something, and I think you've picked up on this. I'm not trying to be polemical in these classes, and by polemical is bash for bashing's sake. In other words, just to make them look as bad as I possibly can. That's what politicians do, especially when they're debating one another. Or often enough it happens, they really try to throw the dirt on each other. You know, this isn't about throwing the dirt as it is to bring out the truth, to look objectively at the facts. And I'm hoping that there will be people that will download these talks, download the study sheets, and see that we're trying to approach this in a spirit of firmness, adherence to Catholic doctrine, but charity and also courage. Our Lord is counting on us to hold strong in the faith in a world that, and I think we'll all agree on this, that wants to water our faith down. It wants to make it harder to be a Catholic. So we have our patron, St. Michael, to help us be strong. And that is true charity, to love our faith, to love Catholic doctrine, and to abhor heresy, to see the problems with modernism and to say, we don't want any part of that. So we will bring up modernism over and over again because, again, it was condemned as the synthesis of all heresies. A canonized pope, saint, declared that, so we can't go wrong in holding to the unchanging truth of the Catholic faith. You know, when the average person on the street here says anything about Vatican II, they'll say, finally, the Catholic Church started to get with the times. Isn't that a fair assessment of what they would say? You're finally getting with it. You're not stuck in the Middle Ages anymore. You've probably heard comments like that. But what we should come back with, and again, I'm hoping to give you tools and resources and information that you can use to share your traditional Catholic faith with others. And the thing you would bring up is, the truth does not change with the times. Doctrine does not change with the times. We have to adhere to what Christ originally meant 2,000 years ago. When he said, for example, this is my body, this is my blood, is there ever going to be a change in the Catholic doctrine on the Holy Eucharist? No. It's going to change it for the modernist, but for us, it doesn't change. That's why we call faith our anchor. I mean, think about that. If you're on a really rough sea and it's too difficult for sailing, what do you want to do? You want to anchor yourself so you don't get swept away by the storm. But what if you have no anchor? What happens? Who knows where you're going to end up? And not only end up somewhere you don't know where you're going to go, but and most likely be shipwrecked, because then you're being tossed on the waves, but you have that anchor. So that's what faith is. It's our anchor. It's our rock. It gives us stability in a world that is changing a lot. But fortunately, our faith doesn't change. Okay, so let's look at our topic for today. We're using tumultuous times. And by the way, I have a couple of copies here if anybody wants to purchase them, $20 each. It's a real bargain, and I recommend it. So I want to do a little bit of wrap-up from John the 23rd. Our class last Tuesday was about John the 23rd, the many problems with him. And one of the things that I discovered is how bad his friend was, who was ordained a priest just a year before him. Let's read about him. Father Ernesto Buonaiuti, his modernist pal, had dared to refute St. Pius X's encyclical on modernism the year after it was published, calling it a response. And he had been a priest for only 5 years and was only 27 years old. He was going to set the Pope straight. No, by any definition, this is colossal pride. Who does he think he is? And I'll show you, I downloaded a copy of this from archive.org or some kind of an obscure resource on the internet, but it has his letter, it's like 150 pages, and he says, we modernists have been attacked and we need to make a response. And almost word for word in his response, he's saying the very things that Pope St. Pius X condemned. It's very illuminating to read this. And plus, who did he get a preface from? He asked an Anglican priest to write the preface for the book. So he's going to a heretic. And basically they're saying we have to go with what we feel, and it feels like something's different happening now. But Pope St. Pius X says that's the very definition of modernism. They go by their feelings. They don't go by objective truth. So this was his friend. And so, again, birds of a feather flock together. Also, another huge problem with John the 23rd, he unsainted, so to speak, St. Philomena. And on February 14th of 1961, the the language that was used there. I mean, just listen to this harsh language. The feast of Saint Philomena, virgin and martyr, is to be expunged from all calendars. What does expunged mean to you? What does that sound like? I'll just ask you what you think. What does it feel like? Wipe it out. Is it a word, parents, you use for your children? You are to expunge the dirt from your bedroom, wash it, completely remove it. Okay. Now notice, she's the first saint to be sent out of the calendar. Another synonym you could use for expunge is rip out. Rip her feast day out of the calendars. Why? Because modernist priests were starting to call into question whether she even existed. But remember, Pope Gregory XVI had issued a formal decree in the 1800s saying that she is to be venerated as a saint. And also, there were so many miracles in the 1800s that she was called the wonder worker of the 19th century. Nobody else has been called that. So you see what the modernists do? They come across a very powerful saint, somebody who God has saved for our times, and they start to throw this modernist aspersions on it. Well, we really don't know much about her. She was in the catacombs for 15 centuries. And so John the 23rd says, well, rip her out of the calendar. And then other saints were sent packing, so to speak. Saint Christopher, well, we don't know if he really ever existed. We don't know about this saint. We don't know about that martyr. This is typical of the modernists. They hate tradition. They hate miracles. So there's a whole book on this, and I'm sorry I didn't bring it to show you. I didn't even mention the reference here, but Patrick Henry Omler wrote a booklet on this called The Unpersoning of Saint Philomena. And he goes into great detail, and he shows the modernists working on this. And why do you think she was the first saint to be eliminated from the calendar? Everywhere in the world, why do you think this? I want to throw that question out to you. Yes. I believe that. What other reasons? Why was Saint Philomena singled out before any other saint to be removed by a modernist from the calendar? Because she was so popular, yes. You know, who had a great devotion to her? Saint John Marie Vianney. Every time a miracle happened in ours, he'd say, oh, that's Saint Philomena. I think a lot of the miracles were worked by him, but being the humble saint that he was, he loved to blame it on Saint Philomena, blame in the respectful sense of the word. My thinking, too, is that the reason she was in the catacombs unknown for 15 centuries, because God was saving her for our times. She is very powerful, patroness of the children of Mary, worker of miracles. And then the modernists have to come along. They have to get rid of her because she's so powerful. And imagine this. Imagine you're the parish priest at Mugnano in Italy that has her relics. And all of a sudden you read this decree one day that says, what? I can't even have a mass in her honor anymore or any feast. Wonder how they handle that. But again, it's typical of modernists to do this kind of thing. So just wanted to mention that to you. Also, one third point about John the 23rd. When it came to the third secret of Fatima, again, what's a fact? A fact is that Sister Lucia, whose first and second secrets were officially approved by the church and released, she said, this secret is to be revealed in 1960. The Blessed Virgin wants it. It will be clearer then in 1960. And what does John the 23rd say? It does not concern the years of my pontificate. And that is supposed to be a quote of his as documented by Frère Michel. So again, the fact is it was supposed to be revealed in 1960. It wasn't. And for 40 years, it was completely suppressed, and supposedly they released it in the year 2000. Yes. Why are they, why do they still have the shrine there? Well, the letter of that, or the exact meaning says the feast is abolished, but it didn't say shut down the shrine because they knew how popular she was and it would cause an insurrection of people. So this is, in my opinion, this is the most they could get away with.
Do they consider her a saint?
Because
you said the feast,
but... Yeah. Why would you say she's a saint and she's not to be acknowledged in any calendar anywhere in the world? Isn't that kind of an effort to deny her? Why do you do this to any saint? I mean, you would think at least they would say, you know, it's to be observed locally. But no, that is... Right, right, it's a mystery to me, you know. In my opinion, as much as they could get away with. So, but they said we can't shut it down; otherwise, we'll have mobs knocking on our door here at the Vatican. What's that? Yeah, test. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yet the modernists love to put doubts into people's minds. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Could it also be in a kind of a combination of, since all these saints that they took away were such miracle workers, and no other sort of religion at the time didn't have those, like, they shouldn't be able to do them. And take those away would make them all sort of evil in the end because then no miracles would happen.
Right. I think that you're alluding to is miracles don't serve the cause of ecumenism, you know, of getting along with all the religions, because there aren't miracles outside, you know, in other religions. So that ends up being an obstacle or a problem. So let's minimize miracles and we'll get along better with all these non-Catholics who don't have it or maybe don't believe in them. So, great point. Okay, so let's look at some more of the groundwork here under letter B. Again, a lot of this is just quoted right from the book. In preparation for Vatican Council II, the first seven schemas were sent out to the bishops of the world in 1962. The modernists disliked the dogmatic ones, but were pleased with the schema on the liturgy prepared by modernists who had been working for a long time. This was something that I wish Pope Pius XII had kept a better eye on, the liturgical movement. Now, there were good things that were happening in the liturgy, some legitimate, I wouldn't say innovations, but legitimate study, legitimate appreciation of very ancient things in the liturgy. But what happened is the modernists really latched onto the liturgy, and they were doing things, they were planning the new mass, I would say, in the 40s and 50s. And unfortunately, Pope Pius XII did not see or was aware of all that they were trying to do. Although he did write an encyclical in 1947, and he said, for example, it would be wrong to go to get rid of black from the liturgy of the church as a liturgical color for masses of the dead. So he knew there were some problems, and there were a few things he condemned, and that was one of them. But what happened in the new mass? What happened to the masses in black? Completely disappeared. Any mass for the departed is the mass of the resurrection. So I think he could have done more. Again, I say that very humbly. Who am I to, you know, to in any to be judging, but I mean, it's the fact is there. He did appoint Father Anibal Bugnini to that commission to study the liturgy, and Bugnini engineered everything. He was the main architect of all the changes in the liturgy, and he was appointed, I believe, in the late 40s. So definitely something I believe Pope Pius XII would have regretted had he known more about what was going on. So anyway, in the area of the liturgy, a lot was going on to already modernize and update. So what the modernists wanted is, since they liked that schema, they said, well, why don't we have it as the first item in the agenda for Vatican II? And they got it on there. And why do you think they wanted to change the liturgy? Let's think about that. Why would you want to change the Mass first? Change the liturgy first? Yes. The law of praying is the law of believing. Yes, absolutely. In other words, the Mass is like a catechism, right? Does the Mass teaches us the Catholic faith? So if you can change the Mass, what are you going to do? You're going to start changing how people believe. So that ended up happening. Okay, so but that's getting ahead of ourselves. Okay, now, do not get warm, fuzzy feelings when you see this phrase, the European Alliance. They were known as the group of modern, you know, of the progressives, they call them the progressives, the liberals, and they were mainly from Germany, Holland, France, and there were some that joined with them from North and South America, and also some missionary bishops. But that again, I've shown you this book. It'd be really good for you to read as a historical resource. The Rhine flows into the Tiber. They co-opted, they hijacked Vatican Council II. They outshouted the conservatives. This is a fact. And Father Ralph Wiltkin, he's writing as a historian. And he was an observer. He was part of the press corps, and he's documenting every day, you know, what's going on at the council. And he published this book in 1966, so it's a year afterwards. And he makes no effort to hide what the European Alliance was trying to accomplish. He said they gained the upper hand. So, have any of you read this book before? The Rhine flows into the Tiber. Okay, you can get, it's not readily available, but you can get copies of it. It's very interesting to read how they seized control. It wasn't the conservatives who seized control, it was the progressives that seized control. Okay, so there's the documentation. Should this bother us, that the progressives seized control? Should this bother us? It bothers us because these people, their idea of the Catholic faith is not our idea of the Catholic faith. We're going to look at some of the names a little bit later on in class today. They wanted to change Catholics' thinking, and they succeeded. This is the problem with Vatican Council II. This is why it has to be scrapped. It was not the triumph of God. It was not the triumph of Christ and his grace. It was the triumph of those who Pope St. Pius X drove underground at the beginning of the century, but 50 years later, 60 years later, now they're able to say, we won. And we'll look into more of those reasons. Okay, and the liberals could not have succeeded without the approval and support that came from John the 23rd and Paul the 6th. Can we jump ahead in our book to page 520? There's a couple of really strong quotes, I would even say scary quotes. And some people will question the authenticity of these quotes, but I've seen them in a number of places. I think they're true because I've seen them come to pass, so that's why I think they were true. But on page 520, these documents were seized from the Alta Vendita, and they were communicated by Pope Gregory the 16th. And this is what the quote is. Our ultimate end is that of Voltaire and of the French Revolution, the final destruction of Catholicism and even of the Christian idea. The work which we have undertaken is not the work of a day, nor of a month, nor of a year. It may last many years, a century perhaps. In our ranks, the soldier dies, but the fight goes on. The third paragraph, make men's hearts corrupt and vicious, and you will no longer have Catholics. Draw away the priests from the altars and from the practice of virtue. Strive to fill their minds and occupy their time with other matters. It is the corruption of the masses we have undertaken, the corruption of people through the clergy and of the clergy by us, the corruption which ought one day to enable us to lay the church in the tomb. How would you feel about somebody who wants to lay your church in the tomb? That's an enemy of the faith, to say the least. We have to think of this. The enemies of the church wanted to destroy the church over and over again through the centuries from the outside. Give me examples. Who was going to destroy the church from the outside? Well, the Arian heresy, okay. Although that kind of got inside the church. I was thinking about those that in no way profess Christianity, wanted to destroy from the outside. Yes, Islam. What else? What other historically? Yes. Well, maybe Galileo, although he didn't succeed very much, he was pretty much silenced, you know. But I'm thinking of the first few centuries of the church. The Roman emperors, they were putting Christians to death by the millions in the first three centuries. The first 30 popes, almost every single one of them was a martyr. I mean, what human institution can stand? You see, it's a divine institution. So over and over again, you had attacks from the outside. So we had the Roman emperors. We had Islam. Heresies try to attack the church from the inside. But from the outside, you have these forces at work. And then in the last 300 years, you had Freemasonry. Name for me a powerful figure in the last over 200 years ago that said he was going to overcome the church. Napoleon. Yes, he threw Pope Pius VII into prison, and he wanted to dominate the church. What happened to Napoleon? He met his fate at Waterloo, and he finished a miserable existence on the island of St. Helena or Elba Island? Elba? Okay. Anyway, he had an inglorious end. I forget which French cardinal was talking to Napoleon. Napoleon said, I want to conquer the church. I'm going to destroy the church. And the cardinal, who must have had Freemasonic leanings, kind of joked about it and said, you know, we cardinals have been trying to do that. We haven't succeeded. So in more modern times, who was going to destroy the church from the outside? Communism. Absolute communism. Who else? What other major evils of the 20th century? Well, communism, yes. Hitler, Nazism, and in Italy, fascism. They were going to destroy the church. They couldn't do it. And so the idea was, if we can't destroy it from the outside, we'll have to do it from the inside. That's what the modernists did. But even there, they're not going to succeed. They can really reduce the number of the faithful who hold to all the doctrines, but they will never destroy the church, because our Lord will be with his church no matter what happens. I will be with you all days, even to the consummation of the world. St. Augustine says, even if there was no miracles in the whole history of the church, the very fact that it is existing after 20 centuries, after so much persecution, is a miracle in itself. So you all belong to a miracle that nobody can destroy, not even Satan. It will suffer, it will go through trials and tribulations, but it cannot be destroyed. But the point here is, they were saying, we have to work at it from the inside. Look at this other quote. This is even more alarming on page 521. Now then, in order to secure to us a pope in the manner required, it is necessary to fashion for that pope a generation worthy of his reign. Let the clergy march under your banner in the belief that they march under the banner of the apostolic keys. Lay your nets like Simon Barjona. Lay them in the depths of sacristies, seminaries, and convents, rather than in the depths of the sea. And if you will precipitate nothing, you will give yourself a draught of fishes more miraculous than his. The fisher of fishes will become a fisher of men. You will bring yourselves as friends around the apostolic chair. I was looking for another quote that says, one day we will have our man on the chair of Peter. This is also from the Alta Vendita, from what I read here. Right. Infiltrate. Yes, absolutely. Infiltration. Right. Absolutely. You know, in the 40s and 50s, there was such an alarm about the entrenched communists in our government that there were, Joseph McCarthy started the, and he's vilified terribly as just being on a witch hunt. But he was right in many of the things. It was because of the communists in our government that, for example, China fell to Mao Zedong. Right. Ronald Reagan was fighting communists as the Screen Actors Guild president. He could see the problem then, and that's why he was so strong against communism. Right. Right. By the way, sister just put this on my desk, this, or on my table here. This is Father Wilkins reprinted, formerly titled The Rhine Flows into the Tiber. So this is available in our bookstore. Okay, so you can read that. It's more on the historical side of things, but it just spells it out. It gives you facts. How this was, there was conniving, there was lying, there was evil forces at work. It's a fact. Okay, so the liberals could not have succeeded at Vatican II if it hadn't been for John the 23rd and Paul the 6th. And we've already shown how John the 23rd was a modernist, and Paul the 6th was even worse. You know, one of the things that just astonishes me, the whole Catholic world didn't rise up and protest. I mean, among many other things, in 1965, Paul the VI came to the United States for the first time. First time ever a pope came to the U.S. And he visits the United Nations, which is basically a godless organization. And I can't believe what he was saying there. He says, you're the last hope of mankind. I think he even said, I lay my church at your feet to be in your service. I mean, how can a Catholic pope say that? Jesus Christ is the answer. He's the solution, not this organization that has lots of communists and unbelievers in it. I mean, what happened to the Catholic world? Why didn't they rise up in protest? No, everybody was just so glad that, you know, a pope was finally coming to visit the U.S. They didn't, you know, they must have heard and read what he said, and it just didn't register or something, or they just didn't care. So, anyway, definitely, they it was because of them. Ultimately. As what's the famous saying, or who said it? The buck stops here. Was it Harry Truman? I think Harry Truman also said, "If you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen." I think he was trying to say deal with it, but I think he says the buck stops here. The responsibility is mine because I'm in charge. So I would say the same thing about this situation. Okay. Let's take a look at the list. I feel like saying the rogues gallery on page 308. Okay. These are the ones that were among the main engineers. Look at these cardinals. Bernard Alfrink, he was from Holland. Augustin Bea, not sure what country he was from. Richard Cushing, he was from the U.S. Julius Döpfner was from Germany. Joseph Frings from Austria or Germany. Franz Koenig, also from Germany or Austria. Paul Legere, he was from Canada. Giacomo Lercaro, they said his ideas were redder than his robes. Yes. Achille Leonhardt, he was accused of being a Freemason, definitely a liberal. Now, I'm not sure about Albert Meyer because I thought he was one of the more conservative ones, but Fathers Francisco and Dominic must know something I don't know. So they have him on the list here. So Joseph Ritter from St. Louis, Leo Souanens from Belgium. So, and among also Patriarch Maximus Saig, and then Archbishop Karol Wojtyła, that's the way to say his name in Polish, by the way, Wojtyła, and then a couple more bishops, but there are a lot more of them, but these are some of the names that come up over and over again. Now, look at the priests who served as parity. Just to explain where we get this, parity comes from the Latin word peritus, which means having experienced. As a matter of fact, that's where we get ex peritus from. And so you see where we get the word expert from. It derives from that. So these were the theological experts. Now, you have to realize that not all cardinals and bishops are, you know, have a very, very deep background in theology. Cardinals and bishops, and this is in the good times too, I mean, they're appointed because they're excellent administrators. Can you imagine the work involved, for example, running the Archdiocese of New York, which has, before Vatican II, had probably like 2 million Catholics. That's a lot of people to organize. So Cardinal Spellman was appointed Archbishop of New York, I think, in 1939. He was there till he died in the mid-60s. So they're administrators. They have a theological background, but when they are called, they have their experts, their parity, who spend a lifetime teaching at the Pontifical University and have ecclesiastical degrees coming out of their ears, so to speak. They're just walking theological brains. So these are their experts. But many of these experts, and this rogues list, these are among the worst modernists of all. So many of them were educated in Germany, in Belgium, and those were the real hotbeds of modernism. So they were infected with this. Let's take a look at some of these names. Gregory Baum, he was from the United States. Marie-Dominique Chenu, Yves Congar, Jean Danielou. As you can read in the footnote, he had a not a very edifying end where he died. Well, since some of you don't have the book, he died of a stroke in a Paris apartment of a young woman nightclub dancer whom he had visited several times previously. You see, when you become a modernist, you lose your not only your faith, but you lose your moral bearings because you no longer cling to objective standards. It becomes feeling. You know, I don't feel that so bad. Gottfried Diekmann, Henry de Lubac, Bernard Herring, it's a German name, but I think he may have been in the U.S., Hans Küng. He is almost the absolute worst. He's still alive, by the way. Hans Küng. He's in his 80s. And, for example, to show you how of a modernist he says, speaking of the Assumption of Our Lady, solemnly proclaimed by Pius XII in 1950, he said, the assumption, it's just an assumption. He was there in St. Peter's Square on November 1st, 1950, when it was solemnly proclaimed. He says, I was so happy. But then he continued his studies with modernist professors, and he ended up not believing in it anymore. And right now, he's planning to kill himself. He has Parkinson's disease, and he says, I don't want to live like John Paul II did, and it's okay. I've worked out a theological explanation where it's not wrong. So he's gonna commit suicide in the very near future. You can look this up yourselves. He makes no apology for this. You see what happens to the modernist mind? You lose your bearings. Everything becomes okay. Yes, he could have been. He's like 80, something like 80. He's in his mid-80s. I absolutely think he was raised to be one of the infiltrators. Okay, Frederick McManus, John Courtney Murray, Karl Rahner, he was a very, very, you know, the Jesuits seem to produce some of the worst heretics. You hate to think that, but, you know, Karl Rahner, who's the evolutionist? Teilhard de Chardin, Jorge Bergoglio, the first Jesuit to become pope. He's terrible. The things he denies. And then Joseph Ratzinger, who later on supposedly became Benedict XVI. You know, there's a photo of him at Vatican II, and I don't think it was just an isolated case. He's wearing a suit, coat, and tie, and he's an ordained priest. What would you think about me if you saw me in a suit, coat, and tie? With that? But would you, you'd start praying for me even more, wouldn't you? Every one of you? Yes. Start wondering if it's, I do not have a suit, coat, and tie. I will not wear a suit, coat, and tie. And right there at St. Peter's, he's wearing a layman's attire. There's photos of this. Why? Again, he has the modernist mindset. By the way, the idea that non-Catholics are Catholics in degree has to be laid squarely at his doorstep. He is the one who invented that. We're going to talk about that some more in our classes. In other words, it was the only way they could make ecumenism work, by saying that you're partially in the church by being a a Lutheran or a Methodist, because you've got some of the Catholic teachings, but not all of them. He invented that concept. He saved ecumenism, you might say. I'm sorry, yes, Claire. Yes, I would agree that modernism does go by degrees, and I think that influenced his thinking. Well, let's apply this to the faith, that you have more or less the degrees that it takes to be a Catholic. Well, Pope St. Pius X said they do progress by degrees. They do want to insinuate their way in. They will use the same words but give them new meanings. And, you know, it's just kind of the gradual approach, but it works, unfortunately. Okay, so we have only about 5 minutes left, so we're going to have to go very fast here. Number six, how bad was it going to be after listening to a speech by Archbishop Montini of Milan? In 1962, Cardinal Ottaviani was heard to murmur, "I pray to God that I die before the end of the council, and that way I can die a Catholic." Can you imagine one of the top cardinals in Rome saying, "I don't even want to see the end of this council. God, please take me." Well, he didn't die. But God saved him to write that famous letter in 1969 condemning the new mass. So God didn't hear Cardinal Ottaviani's prayer for a good reason. But he was one of the good cardinals, and they were just in agony during Vatican Council too. I mean, obviously, sometimes they did hear true Catholic doctrine spoken about, but, you know, if you mix that in with heresy, what do you got? You know, so anyway, non-Catholic observers invited to the council. I'm going to put the microphone down here. I'm going to do a little bit of show and tell. I have this big book of pictures of Vatican II. So anyway, in that picture, it shows the modernists with their fronts, or the non-Catholic observers in a prime location there for the council. Now, it is true that non-Catholics were invited to past councils. The Orthodox, the schismatics, were repeatedly invited. Can anybody tell me why the Council of Trent was held in Trent instead of in Rome 500 years ago, or almost 500 years ago? I mean, what's Trent? I mean, it's just a little village up there in northern Italy. Why was the Council of Trent held there? What's that? To make it a lot closer to Germany, where the problem with the Protestants was. So it was the church saying, "We're going to come close to you, and we invite you to come." I don't think any of them came, because the idea was, we're going to try to help you see the truth of the Catholic faith. So that has happened before, but now when they're saying to all these non-Catholics, "You're part of the church in varying degrees," well, that's basically saying, what's the point of even converting? So I don't think any of them converted. They all stayed the way they were. Okay, running out of time. So we had 93 official non-Catholic observers. Non-Catholics were given copies of agendas, had access to all conciliar documents, mingled freely with the Council Fathers. "I am more and more amazed every morning at the way we really form part of the Council." That was one of the non-Catholics, heretics, who was there. And he should have seen the Catholic faith explained to him, but instead he saw them saying, how can we accommodate to all of the non-Catholic religions? So we have the non, okay, top of page 314 in our book, they even had a couple of coffee and regular bars inside St. Peter's. I think if they had spent more time doing holy hours instead of visiting the bars, does that sound right, to have a bar inside of St. Peter's sacristy, another one behind the main altar? A good deal of the real business and certainly most of the human interaction of Vatican II took place elsewhere. And for example, the two coffee bars where snacks, brandy, schnapps, and espresso were served. They called them Bar Jonah and Bar Mitzvah. Not very edifying, to say the least. Okay, we'll have to stop here. Basically, I'll wrap it up in a minute. Many of the good bishops wanted a condemnation of communism. Nothing happened. And it was like the elephant in the room, right? Who remembers in the 1950s and 60s doing drills in the classroom in case there was a nuclear attack? I remember doing those. It was, right, we might be happening now with North Korea. So anyway, that was at the very height or peak of the Cold War. Shouldn't we say something about communism? No, we might displease the communists. And most of the bishops from the communist countries could not come. They weren't allowed, or they were in jail. They were suffering for the faith. And something should have been said, but it wasn't. So it would be like during World War II, if there was a council of the church, we're not going to say anything about Nazism or fascism. I mean, it's the most obvious, one of the most obvious problems going on. Say something, remind the faithful not to have anything to do with communism. But that would have gotten in the way of ecumenism, it would have gotten in the way of liberation theology and other problems that the modernists didn't want to deal with. So they just let it go. Okay, we'll stop here today. Thank you.